It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. Ann Strainchamps is out today. I'm Sarah Nix. In this hour, urban cultures. It's the great age of urbanization. In India and China, hundreds of millions of people are moving into cities. Even here in the U.S., more Americans are living urban than ever before. But there's more to city living than smaller homes, fewer parking spots, and more restaurants. Throughout human history, cities have been the cradle for cultural innovation. New philosophies, new art, new ways of living. And sometimes those new ideas have gone global, carrying with them the essence of their hometown.
My life is deeply intermingled, embedded in this city. So when I decided to write autobiographical essays, then I realized that it will be deeply about the city.
That's Orhan Pamuk. Shortly before he won the Nobel Prize for Literature, he published a collection of early memoirs and named it after his hometown, Istanbul. Steve Paulson asked him how that city shaped his work.
Till the age of 22, I thought that I would be a painter. I used to paint a lot of cityscapes under the influence of French impressionists. And I was also thinking, what's this all about? And then the feeling that Baudelaire and other French writers developed the idea that the value of a landscape painting is associated with the feeling it evokes. And I ask myself, wow, maybe it's a good time to ask myself, what do I associate the Istanbul of my childhood? Then, of course, it was melancholy or Turkish melancholy, which is hüzün.
A great city from the past, but the greatness has faded
ago. Istanbul was an empire, city that ran empire for thousands of years. In fact, I sometimes think that I spend my childhood in a city which led to a thousand year of glories, and when the glory is finished, I was born. So I lived in that city with a feeling of, wow, they were rich, but it's all gone. What is left is a ruins of Ottoman Empire and the ruins of Ottoman modernity.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that you write about in your memoir is, I mean, you say that Turks also take pride in this sense of melancholy. There's honor, there's nobility, there's beauty in it.
Okay, melancholy, Turkish melancholy is related not only to landscape, but it's also related to living next to Europe. So we had this feeling of, wow, we are so close to success of Europe, but we are living a poor life. And after a while, that if you can't change that life, you have a fatalistic understanding of your city and your civilization and your nation and life. This is also related to the common feeling that the man should have, especially that you should resign in life. Success in life is something selfish and individualistic to ask for. Don't ask questions about your personal happiness, but ask about the happiness of the community. Turkish melancholy hüzün is a communal feeling of resignation. In that sense, it can be compared to Japanese nobility of failure.
Now, do you think the sensibility of Turkish melancholy hüzün, is that still with the people of Istanbul today? I mean, most of your memoir takes place in the 1950s and 60s when you were growing up, and Istanbul was a very different city. I mean, what a city of a million people then, and now it's 14 million?
When I was born into it in 1952, Istanbul was a city of a million. When I wrote my memoirs in 2002, I think it was around 9-10 million. I am talking about my Istanbul of 50s, 60s, 70s, and the book ends 40 years ago. The Istanbul I describe, I warn my future readers, is an Istanbul of 40 years ago.
Hmm. Of course, the fascination that so many people, including me, have with Istanbul is it straddles both Europe and Asia. I mean, literally. I don't know if there's another major city in the world that physically is occupying these two continents. And it raises the question of, I guess, how you see your identity. I mean, do you think of yourself as both European and Asian?
People of Istanbul never think of this. It's like going from Asia to Europe is like going from Manhattan to Brooklyn to see a friend. You don't notice it. my way of looking at things in Istanbul is how interestingly things from different sources come together, not only in daily life objects, in architecture, in landscapes, in the daily life of the people. Things come together harmoniously, gracefully, if you pay attention to that.
Now, the other thing that you've done is you actually created your own museum, the museum.
But it's not about me, man. You say your own museum.
But you did it, and it's all based on the novel you wrote, Museum of Innocence, and which I have to say is such a unique idea. I mean, to create a novel and then to build a museum that's based on what you wrote about in the novel.
I wrote a novel called Museum of Innocence, which is also a novel of love, to explore what happens to us as we fall in love. One of the things that happens to us, we get attached to things that may make us remember our beloved. My story is such that is not a very happy story, and the male character collects everything his beloved touches. At the end, the story is sad. He is left with all the objects, and he has an idea of making a museum. I wrote the novel and also collected all the objects that the lovers talk about, touch, some 2,000 objects, then put them in a museum. The idea was that the annotated museum catalog will also read like a novel. But it's also, I argue, a small city museum of Istanbul, the first, exhibiting objects of 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s of Istanbul's secular, westernized middle classes, what they wore, the newspapers they read, the films they show, things they eat. Every paper, every object, including toothbrushes, which was very hard to find.
I can imagine. Was this trying to capture a certain period of Istanbul history? Are you worried that that's going to disappear and we won't have a record of it?
I had that. We are always worried. That's where art and literature comes. When you write a novel, you're also aware of preserving, you know, how you take a taxi in Istanbul, how you wait in a line to go into a bus, how you go to a shop and do a little bargaining if you're even buying some regular thing. Novels have museum qualities, that of honoring our lives, paying attention to details of our lives, hoping that others be interested. I argue and strongly think that museums and novels have this same capacity to preserve the delights or sometimes sadness of our lives.
Hmm. Well, and from what I've heard, you went to extraordinary lengths to try to recreate the objects in your novel. I mean, for instance, you collected, what, 4,213 cigarette butts, because that is the number of cigarette butts that the heroine, who your main character has fallen in love with. You know, he wants to sort of cherish those memories. And the thing is, you can't just hang on to cigarette butts. The tobacco is going to go bad. So you have to, somehow?
I had the cigarettes, but then before we were exhibiting them, we said, someone said, tobacco will spoil. So what do? We were shocked. So we decided then we will invent a new tobacco that will stay. So we found a guy who said we produced a combination of paper and color and some chemical materials. Then we emptied the old cigarettes, then put inside artificial tobacco and also painted them with lipstick color one by one. Some of the objects in our museum are what Marcel Duchamp would say, ready-mades, because I found it from a friend or in flea markets or someone lends. Some of them was hard to find, like toothbrushes, because no one preserves his old toothbrushes. Some of them are imaginary objects, such as in the novel, there is a first Turkish soda pop. So I invented that. We did the design of the bottle. We did the advertisement campaign. I am not nostalgic.
I was going to ask that, because it sort of sounds like an exercise in nostalgia.
Nostalgia is reasonable when you are happy. I was happy with my friends and childhood. It was an affluent childhood. But on the other hand, I was not happy living in a poor country where there was no prospects of future.
Are you happy with the city that Istanbul has become? I mean, now that it is this huge city of 14 million people, very modern, it's the economy is booming. I mean, to some degree, the old Istanbul that you've been describing is disappearing.
I think that's too much exaggeration. The city is getting rich. Lower classes are also getting to be more middle class like. After complaining about poverty for 40 years, once you get rich, complaining is not honest for me. But then the good, interesting job of making beautiful things, paying extra attention to urban planning, architectural beauties that will signify this immense economical success are not there. This is the weak point now, and they are rightfully being criticized for it.
That's Orhan Pamuk. His collection of autobiographical essays is called Istanbul. So, a city can shape the emotional life of the people who live there, but can one city change the whole world? Historian Russell Shorto thinks so. In his books about New York and Amsterdam, he makes the case that the new liberal ideas springing up in the Netherlands in the 1600s shaped the new world. When I was in Amsterdam earlier this year, I called him up for a tour.
So here I am at Amsterdam Central Station, and there are trams going by. It's a beautiful sunny day. What would I have seen 300, 400 years ago?
Okay, so now, you know, looking in front of you, you see, you know, buses and trams.
Tourists,
and it's probably, you know, the least historically seeming cityscape you could imagine. But if you walk, you know, 100 yards or so ahead, you will come right to the first of the canals, which points its way into the city center. That's the Damrak. And if you can stand there, you wouldn't even necessarily be aware of it, but you're actually on a bridge, which is called the New Bridge. On your left is a row of 17th century townhouses.
Yeah.
So in the Middle Ages, in Europe, the economic system, the social structure, was what's called the manorial system. You had a nobleman who lived in a castle, and he had land, and there were serfs or peasants who worked on that land, and they paid crops or rent to him, and he provided protection. That was the structure of society.
And the land was not yours.
Here, they started to remake the land. Where you're standing now is actually just about on top of a dike ring that was built in the Middle Ages. And that was built to protect Amsterdam.
Built to protect it from the sea as opposed to from invaders?
Yeah, exactly, from the water. And then they have this new land, and it's not owned by the king, it's not owned by the church or a nobleman, it's owned by the people who did this work to reclaim it. So they then divide it up into parcels and build their houses on it and begin buying and selling it.
So is this the first real instance of private land ownership in this part of the world?
On a scale that was so large that it was the norm, yeah. And by, you know, relatively ordinary people. So they became the owners, and they began buying and selling, and that then set off this kind of spirit of innovation. You know, they were already a shipping country, and so they developed the shipping empire. So the next innovation in all of this, 1602, a new kind of company came into being. Before that time, a bunch of people got together, the ships went out, the ships came back, the venture dissolved. They divided up whatever profit there was, and it was done.
So it's like a short-term investment, almost.
It always was that kind of thing. In 1602, they founded the Dutch East India Company. And the big innovation was this would be a permanent company. If you buy a piece of this company, it's going to stay around, and therefore you have the right to sell your share later. So this then creates the concept of shares of stock. And so where you're standing then, that's where everybody, when they were coming from the ships, this spot, the New Bridge, became the world's first true stock market, where people would buy and trade these pieces of paper that represented pieces of the Dutch East India Company.
This emergent way of doing business and of building land and of owning private land, what kind of impact do you think that had in terms of the political philosophy that grew out from the Netherlands?
Yeah, I think all the things basically that you associate with Amsterdam in the golden age, are related to this. Art turned to the secular. You know, art, by and large, up to that point, was religious-themed. Suddenly, the art of Rembrandt and Vermeer were suddenly painting individuals in ordinary settings, you know, a woman pouring milk into a bowl or something. I mean, it was expressed maybe most cogently in the philosophy of Spinoza, who was an Amsterdam merchant. He soaked all of this in, and it all became part of his philosophy, which argued essentially that if the individual is so important, then it follows that the only political philosophy that really has validity is one in which every individual has an equal say in the government. So this notion then very quickly extends in all directions.
You and I are going to pick up this conversation in New York, and presumably the ships sailed out of here, out of this port, to go to the New World.
Yeah. Oh, exactly. It would have these stupendous world historic consequences, one of which was the founding of New York City.
Well, I guess I'll talk to you on the other side of the Atlantic then.
Okay, Sarah, have a good trip.
Back to our story tracing the links from Amsterdam to New York, when I landed in Manhattan, I called up Russell Shorto again, this time from Battery Park, looking out at New York Harbor and the Statue of Liberty.
This is Wall Street.
It's beautiful out here. The flags are flapping in the wind, but the lady looks beautiful, and we've made it to the other side of the Atlantic.
Okay, so you're looking out over the Inner Harbor.
Yep.
Nice.
Tell me how the history of this place begins as it applies to European culture.
Okay. So on the other side of the Atlantic, the city of Amsterdam rose largely on the Dutch East India Company. They wanted to find a shortcut to Asia, and they hired the Englishman Henry Hudson. So he sailed to America, sailed up the coast. The Dutch laid claim to this whole territory. So eventually they learned that you follow the Hudson River up to the Mohawk, and then the Mohawk goes west, and that goes all the way to the Great Lakes. So they knew that that was the way to get at North America. So on the strength of that, they found this colony called New Netherland.
So talk a little bit about some of the principles that the Dutch carried with them.
Well, I think there's two things that they brought that was really different from what the English brought to their colonies. Their approach to free trade, to capitalism, which they were perfecting in Amsterdam with the first stock market and so on. And they brought this notion of tolerance. I mean, the Dutch Republic was kind of the melting pot of Europe, and they were relatively tolerant of other religions. And so those two things together, tolerance and free trade, are kind of a recipe for New York City. I mean, if you just kind of add water and add time, I mean, then the skyscrapers start to grow. That's kind of what set New York apart from Boston and anywhere in English North America.
And what are some of the philosophical underpinnings that the Dutch carried with them in terms of land politics in the very early days? You said that the entire territory was claimed, I'm assuming, for the Dutch crown, is that right?
No, there wasn't a crown. I mean, there were individual landowners. I mean, if you look at a map of Manhattan Island in the Dutch period, it looks completely settled because it was divided up and you saw somebody's name on each plot. This colony was developing at a really interesting time in the 17th century, when there were these beginnings of ideas about individual liberty and freedom of religion, and you know, it would be 100 years before they really took off. Who knows what it would have been had it stayed Dutch.
So how much would you say that the ethos of Manhattan and perhaps the Northeast, if not the entire country, owes to those early kind of philosophical changes that were happening thanks to the development of the Netherlands and of Amsterdam, the original.
Yeah, how much is a scary thing to say, but it's certainly a part of things. I mean, it was founded by the Dutch, and it became very quickly this multi-ethnic free trading port. Then if you jump into the 19th century, then you have the great waves of immigrants coming from Europe, making footfall on Manhattan Island and seeing what was by then this teeming mix of different kinds of ethnicities, worshiping different faiths and speaking different languages and all. And they took this all in and said, oh, well, this is America. But, you know, it wasn't really America yet. It was New York. And it was New York because it had been New Amsterdam. Many of them eventually then moved westward. They went to Ohio. They went all the way to California. And they brought that with them. So they made it America. So, you know, in that kind of subterranean way, you know, what this small group of people in the 17th century were doing came to be part of the American DNA, you might say.
That's Russell Shorto. His book about New York is called The Island at the Center of the World. His book on Amsterdam, which he calls a prequel to the New York book, is Amsterdam, a History of the World's Most Liberal City. So, right, Istanbul, New York, Amsterdam, of course they have unique cultures. But is the same true for less obvious spots? In his new book, Unruly Places, social geographer Alistair Bonnet writes that familiar places can also be extraordinary. Doug Gordon asked Bonnet when he first realized the power of place.
My brother, Paul, and I, we used to make these dens, flatten down some sticks in these ugly old bushes around the corner from our house. And to the rest of the world, it looked pretty squalid, I'm sure. But to us, it was fantastic. And we were able to stretch and use our imaginations, like all kids do, and think about what's the kitchen, and this is where the dragon lives, and I'm bringing in the marmalade. I don't know. And that is, I think, for a lot of us, our first contact with place, yeah. Making place.
Yeah, inventing our own places, our own private places.
Yeah. And that is something I come back to time and time again. For places that work, places that are enthralling, they kind of remind us of these early childhood places. I think we're all very familiar these days about places that look pretty much the same, and we can often move or drive between different places and not really realize we've even moved at all because they're all becoming a little bit identikit.
Are these the generic landscapes? Are these the strip malls and housing estates that you're talking about?
They are. And it's not just the landscape. It's the fact that it's so easy to move between them and to spend all your life thinking about moving and traveling and mobility rather than the places where you might want to arrive at.
What kind of impact do you think those landscapes have on us, not just as individuals, but on local culture as well?
Well, you know, some people think it doesn't matter. But I make the case in this book that places are fundamental to human identity. And if we don't have distinct places, places which are able to give us a unique and interesting sense of our own personal identity, then we lack something. We become continuously dissatisfied. There is a lot of angst out there in our relationship to place. And I think a lot of us want a more intense and more interesting relationship to place.
Mm-hmm. You also say that we're better at destroying places than building them. I thought the example about Mecca in Saudi Arabia was really surprising.
Yeah, it is surprising. I mean, 95% of old Mecca has been demolished, and it's
wow.
been got rid of for strip malls, for Starbucks, and for highways and parking lots. It hasn't been got rid of for mosques or anything like that. Although the actual rationale for the destruction is religious. The authorities in Saudi Arabia say, well, we mustn't have old buildings because people start to venerate old buildings. And the only thing that should be venerated is Allah. And with this excuse, they've demolished this beautiful ancient city and replaced it with a generic landscape. What an extraordinary story.
Which, of course, raises the question, is the power of place really potent enough to threaten people who are determined to shape a culture their way?
Yes, it seems so. Old places and memories instilled in old places do seem to be one of the enemies of people who want to impose an ideology. And this is true of Mecca, but it's also true of what happened in Soviet Russia or in communist China. The first thing that these authoritarian regimes turn their attention to, or one of the first things, is the places of the past and getting rid of those old places and building their kind of shiny new city is their way of cementing their ideology.
Yeah, it makes me, the situation in Mecca makes me think of that Picasso quote, every act of creation is first an act of destruction. Is there a chance that Mecca could possibly reinvent itself? And
that's interesting, isn't it? But when all you've got is destruction, it's very difficult to see how that can lead to a future, and creative possibilities.
Yeah.
There has to be a balance between these forces. What one finds in destroyed landscapes is memories. People are going to be nostalgic for old Mecca because that's the one thing you can't destroy, the sense of loss.
Mm-hmm. The memories, yeah, that live on.
Yeah.
Throughout the book, there's a theme about how being more curious about our cities, towns, parking lots, highway islands can kind of enliven the places we live. Do you think that engaging our places in a new way can make for more imaginative and creative culture too?
Yeah, I think so. I think we often think about buildings and architecture separately from this broader concept of place. What I'm trying to do is get us to realize that a imaginative relationship to place is actually central to a enjoyable, creative and happy culture. And one of the things that stimulated me actually was the urban exploration movement in the US.
Mm-hmm.
People who have decided that the new frontier of exploration is under the streets of their cities or in the abandoned buildings. These are the explorers that are trying to imaginatively recolonize the day-to-day city and find within or under it undiscovered possibilities.
Have you done any urban exploration yourself?
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, I'm claiming to be in at the start of this thing.
Okay.
We didn't call it urban exploration. We called it psychogeography. And it was in the early 90s I started this magazine on what came to be called urban exploration. And, yeah, we were following maps of the Berlin metro around different cities in Britain, using the wrong map, as it were, to guide you around, which can get you into all sorts of interesting locations.
Yeah, didn't you use the Berlin subway map to guide you or orient you, or should I say disorient you, as you were going through a Newcastle daycare center?
Yeah,
what did that accomplish?
Well, what did it accomplish? Well, it got us really profoundly lost and it disorientated us. And the idea is you only see the city afresh and anew if you are prepared to get lost. We had this kind of, ideological avant-garde agenda, to be honest. And the urban explorers of today have, I think, thankfully and quite rightly rid themselves of a lot of that baggage. A lot of them are just on there for the ride and for the pleasure. We imagined it was some sort of incredibly subversive political act wandering through a daycare centre using the map of the Berlin metro system. News to us, it wasn't. It had no particular political ramifications.
You haven't tried the reverse, have you, Alistair? Like taking the Newcastle Daycare Centre floor plan and tried to use it to navigate your way around the Berlin subway, have you?
That is such a good idea.
There it is. We should do that. I'll come over and we'll do that. We'll meet in Berlin and do this. But do you think there's a way that sense of place has an effect on us, not just as individuals, but also on the culture, both ruly and unruly places?
Well, place is a collective enterprise. That's one of its glories. A connection to people through time and a connection to the other people that might occupy that spot. Oh. So place is always a collective thing. It's always about people, not just me or not just you. And those societies that are losing their sense of place, and to be honest, that's nearly all of us. Sometimes people in America imagine they have a particular problem with nowhere landscapes or generic retail malls, and that isn't the case at all. You can go into Italy or France or Britain or any country in the face of the world today, and people are asking the same questions because they're seeing the same things out of their windows. They're seeing places which did have have distinct identities being replaced by non-places. And which society is answering these questions best at the moment? Well, it's going to be those societies which are, you know, asking the question, which are forcing themselves to confront this dilemma of place.
In Unruly Places, you mentioned the new ghost towns in China. And China's in the midst of this great project to build entirely new cities to house millions of people in from the countryside. In fact, this is the new age of urbanization, with cities growing faster than ever. If you could advise urban planners on how to build a vibrant, engaging place from scratch, what would you tell them?
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, there is a challenge, but the places that work do tend to be ones that are drawing on something. They draw on a history. Everywhere we want to build, people have built before. And the mistake is to imagine that one can erase all that and create so-called new towns. So my advice would always be, look for the history, look for the roots, draw on the styles and architectural references that existed in that place before. And that isn't just a question of aesthetics. It's because I think people psychologically and culturally need a sense of historical continuity. I think that we can feel a little bit alienated by the idea of the kind of tabula rasa of having to do everything ourselves in an empty moonscape.
That's social geographer Alistair Bonnett. His new book is Unruly Places. So maybe you've read about the great urbanization that's happening in China these days. The country's planning to move more than 100 million people into cities by 2020. For a long time, a national registration system has reinforced two distinct classes of people there. What kind of healthcare, education, and other government support you get depends on whether you're registered as an urban or rural person. Earlier this year, China announced it's slowly phasing out the registration system as it moves people out of the countryside. But Tufts urban planning professor Weiping Wu says that actually, rural migrants have already been moving into the cities for a couple of decades now. Anne Strainchamps asked her how that's changing China's biggest city, Shanghai.
Yeah, Shanghai is indeed the largest city in China, and it's getting close to be the biggest in the world as well. And it's really interesting. It's only since 2000, the census, that we start really counting migrants in the population. And so before that, we had about 11 or 12 million local residents. But since then, the number of migrants has really drastically grown. Now, about a third is migrants. So it's just a very, very large inflow for the city. And the city is, in some ways, has managed well in the sense that it has used some of the transient housing that it used to use for local populations, for migrants, rent out to them, allowing for a space for some migrant schools to operate. Although the challenge is, if Shanghai or any other large city is being more welcoming to migrants, then you will have more migrants coming in. And so it's quite a paradox for these large cities.
How does this play out culturally? Because it sounds like you're talking about a city with two extremely different populations. If a third are newcomers, migrants, and then they're the city residents who maybe have been there for generations.
Primarily, I think it is culturally different in terms of dialects, in terms of appearances, in terms of level of education. You know, it's so interesting. You know, Shanghai actually is a city of migrants. So 1840, you know, the Opium War time, Shanghai was a small fishing village. It was not a big city. And it became a very large city in the first part of the 20th century. So in that matter of 100 years, Shanghai really grew. But how? By migrants. In fact, there are very few people who can say they're really Shanghainese. So you would think Shanghainese would be more accommodating to migrants, but that's not necessarily true. So in a way, it's very similar to U.S., where, you know, we are a melting pot, but, you know, we have this attitude towards new immigrants. But I have to say, you know, I've studied migrants since late 1990s. I think the attitudes of city folks are really changing, maybe slowly, but certainly more positively.
How do you see that? Are there things that people would have said before about a newcomer that they would not, in general, wouldn't say now?
For instance, yeah, I mean, in the late 90s and early 2000s, you know, if, you know, we began to see some more crimes and, that's because we have so many migrants. I think you hear a lot less of that now. And part of the thing is that the local residents interact with the migrants so frequently on a daily basis. You know, look at my parents. They have an hourly help inside their house. She's a migrant. So a lot of Shanghai households use these hourly domestic help. And almost all of them are migrants.
What is this category, migrant?
Right. So in the official enumeration, a migrant is someone who lives in a place other than his or her place of household registration. The Chinese actually has a very interesting name for that. They are floating population, 流动人口. In fact, that is true. A lot of migrants move from city to cities. And then even when they come to a city like Shanghai, they move much, much more frequently than local residents in terms of where they live.
Is this comparable to the migrant labor population in the U.S., or is it rather different?
A colleague of mine and I have done a sort of a little comparative work that we look at the similarities between China's migrants and the undocumented immigrants in the United States. In some ways, they're similar because they encounter a number of restrictions in terms of looking for jobs, even in terms of access to certain types of low-cost or affordable housing.
So then what happens when you get these two cultures sharing the same space in a city like Shanghai? I mean, do you see that class divide shaping the way the city is growing?
So when we were looking at both 2000 census and 2010 census data, a number of neighborhoods just outside of the central city are increasingly more and more populated by migrants. And so you have these very interesting subcultures that, you know, migrants open up small restaurants and their customers are almost all migrants as well. Mm. And also you go to what we call the urban villages that are areas that used to be rural in the edges of the metropolitan Shanghai. But now the farmers don't have land anymore because they've been developed, but they still have their old village housing. So a lot of migrants are renting those village housing. And so they really concentrate over there.
That's interesting because I was thinking about simply the appearance of the city. And I was thinking, you know, Shanghai has to be building on a scale that humans have almost never seen. And it sounds like it's not just that they're building these huge mega skyscrapers, but also that the city is growing out. It's, you know, sprawling.
That is correct. Yes, actually, it's sprawling, but it's in a different way from American cities, maybe with exception of New York or to some extent Boston or San Francisco. That is, the central city, the downtown, is really, really important. Everybody wants to be there if they could, and it's very high density. But on the other hand, it's not affordable for many people, so it is spreading out. It is dense, it's a lot more people, a lot more crowded, and it is much more convenient. That is to say, I used to joke with some of the Chinese students who come from Shanghai, and I used to teach in Richmond, Virginia, and no bad words about Richmond, Virginia, but they came and they go like, what am I supposed to do at night? There's nothing to do. You know, in Shanghai, you know, 2 a.m., whatever, you know, you feel absolutely safe as a woman by yourself to walk in most places. And there will be eateries open all over the place. It's exciting, it's chaotic, it's noisy, but it's just really energetic. And you feel like it's so much fun just walking on the street and looking at other people. And so if you want a peace and quiet, that's not what you're going to get.
As an American listening to you, I'm wondering, seeing how much Shanghai has changed and shifted and adapted over the last decade or so, are there any particular lessons we here in the U.S. could take from that?
Well, I think it does take collective actions. So, for instance, when I was young, when I would go to Shanghai and they had these, you know, slangs, then you are from outside, you don't know how to speak Shanghai dialects, blah, blah, blah. So for a long time, actually, the Chinese government started to force all schools to learn Mandarin so that people from different places can live in the same city, you know. So actually, it's gotten really a lot easier to get around in Shanghai without speaking Shanghainese. So in a sense, there's quite a bit of a strong hand of the state, you know, the government, mm-hmm. in sort of managing how the sort of different streams of population can mix and intermingle. And so maybe that's something that I think it's this, you know, it's almost like you go to Australia and you go to Canada and you see a lot more multiculturalism. It's because, you know, the government makes a real conscious effort to promote that. And I think that's really important.
Weiping Wu teaches at Tufts University. Her latest book is The Chinese City. And that's our urban exploration for this hour. Coming up, novelist Stephen Eric Clark on why we should subdivide the U.S. into a bunch of smaller countries. And as the shooting of Michael Brown prompts a new round of calls for a national conversation about race, NPR's Michelle Norris shares a story about a family secret that sparked some uncomfortable conversations.
She carried so much anger with her. I mean, more anger than I have ever heard expressed by any member of my family.
I'm Sarah Nix, in for Anne Strainchamps, and this is To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now it's time for a dangerous idea.
I'm Stephen Eric Clark, author of the novel Sweetness No. 9. My dangerous idea is to break up the United States into at least a half dozen different countries. I'm sure many of you hear that and think it's the most unpatriotic and un-American thing imaginable. But if America was built on the principles of personal freedom and innovation, I would argue that a handful of smaller, less centralized countries would improve upon the arrangement we currently have. I do wish that we could still debate and develop bipartisan support for a wide range of new ideas, and with the culture of gridlock in Washington, I don't think that's possible. We're as deeply divided as I remember us being, and our differences are often as geographical as they are political. We speak of red states and blue states, the coasts and flyover country, rural interests and urban. Well, what if we created a system whereby there was more consensus built into that system? What if New England was one country and the Pacific Northwest another? What if California and Texas were not states but nations, and the American South a country that could implement social changes that would be embraced there but rejected elsewhere? In the last decade, I've heard a lot of talk about the need to fix the immigration system and the IRS. The public has rallied for and against gay marriage, demanded an end to the war in Iraq, and action against global warming. We won a lot, but we rarely get very much, and when we do get something drastically different, like Obamacare, it's usually a watered-down derivative of a better idea, something that makes few people happy. I say the size and complexity of our nation, far larger than the original 13 colonies, plays a part in our inability to bring about anything more than a loud argument. We've become like a battleship. It takes a long time for us to turn around and chart a new course. Some people would say that's how any good democracy should be. If you can bring about change too easily, you could easily turn your back on your nation's most basic principles. But I would argue that while there are things we need to protect, there is also a need to do more than we're doing today. The demands of our time, global warming, income inequality, are too great for us to sit around discussing changes that never get brought about. Remember, bigger things are not necessarily better. Internet companies know this. Even giants like Google encourage their engineers to work in small teams, believing this will lead to improved productivity and more innovation. The same is true for countries. If 6 or 9 of them emerge from within the borders of the former United States, a community of competing ideas could emerge. Is a single-payer system of healthcare best? Should abortion be legal or illegal? Should more be done to make our lives and cities more green? If we retained freedom of movement, we'd be able to vote with our feet. If we didn't like what our smaller, more nimble representative government was doing, we could move to a region more aligned with our ideas. As for the consequences on the global stage, one of the emergent countries couldn't expect to wage an endless war or exert the influence of a single superpower. But some might say that would be a good thing, too, as it would foster a need for more coalition building.
That's novelist Stephen Eric Clark. For more dangerous ideas, check out our website, ttbook.org. And now it's time for On Our Minds. With the repercussion of the Michael Brown shooting still in the headlines, we're hearing a new round of calls for a national conversation about racism. But is that possible? And are we ready for what we might hear? A few years ago, NPR's Michelle Norris wrote a family memoir called The Grace of Silence. She told Anne Strainchamps it all started when she learned about a secret her father had hidden for decades.
Well, I learned about it from an uncle who just blurted it out one day while we were having breakfast. He was upset about young people not voting and that they didn't realize that, you know, all the sacrifices that had been made. Well, you know your father was shot. And he regretted saying it immediately. He sort of pushed his food away and said, okay, you know, I'll tell you what I know, which was not much. So then I have to go through this sort of anthropological process to go to relatives who I thought may have known. And, you know, calling up people who I knew had this secret and trying to figure out, how do I ask these elders to share this with me? Because they kept it a secret for a reason. Are they trying to honor my father's secret? And of course, I couldn't, the daughter in me couldn't let it go. The journalist in me couldn't let it go. I felt this magnetic pull. And I just had to keep knocking and knocking and knocking on doors until I finally got people to talk to me about it.
But it's like pulling on a ball of yarn.
Yeah.
You know? You just kept pulling and pulling. But clearly, it was a tremendous shock to you.
It was hard for me to swallow this, in part because of the man I knew. My father was a postal worker who raised his kids on the south side of Minneapolis. He was a by-the-book guy. He was very gentle and very kind, you know, this sort of quiet wisdom about him. And he was just, he was very optimistic, and people liked to be in his orbit because of that.
So this really doesn't fit with the picture of a young man who was shot by a white
police
officer. Well,
and it wasn't just that the picture of him being shot. It was what led up to the shooting. My dad returned to Birmingham at a period where the city was full of black veterans who were coming back. And they came back as changed men. And they were met with disappointment and rejection time and time again. And my father, what surprised me so much, given what I knew about him, is that he was on that February evening in 1946, trying to enter a public building, and a policeman tried to stop him, and he stood up to the policeman. He confronted the policeman, which is something I just could not imagine. This is a guy who would, like, fuss at us if we jaywalked. He stood up to this police officer, and a scuffle ensued, and a police officer's gun went off, and that's when the bullet grazed the side of his leg.
I mean, put that in some context. What does that mean? For a young black man to stand up to a police officer.
In the first 6 weeks of 1946, half a dozen returning black veterans were killed by police officers in and around Birmingham. One of them was shot because there was a colored-only sign, and he said, I'm wearing a U.S. military uniform. I don't need to honor that sign. I'm going to move it. And in that case, a scuffle ensued, and he was shot in the head. His name was Timothy Hood. He died. There were cases where they were trying to vote, and if they knew that they were trying to vote, meaning the authorities, they might be visited in the dark of night. I mean, it was throughout the year 1946, this was not limited to Birmingham. Across the country, black veterans were beaten and burned and lynched, castrated, maimed. It was the blinding of a black veteran 3 hours after he was honorably discharged from the Army that so troubled Harry Truman that he appointed the commission that led to the full integration of the armed services. And I tried to talk to veterans who were returning to America at that time. And what they describe is this moment where they just decide that their manhood is more important than the strictures that have been forced down their throat all their lives.
And they had lived in the military with a different code and a different sense of who they were and how much respect they were due. And they're supposed to put that down when they come home?
Mm-hmm. So many of them painted a picture that began to make sense to me when I looked at my dad's life. If you had that experience, it would be easy to live the rest of your life as a malcontent and just say, forget it. I'm not going to play by anybody's rules anymore. Instead, they took a different course. They tended to follow a very similar path. They decided collectively to live these lives of utter rectitude. I mean, they went the other way. Instead of, like, saying, I'm not going to follow anybody's rules, they followed the rules to the letter. They dressed impeccably. They kept their homes just so. Their cars were always, you know, you could see yourself in the chrome. They made sure that no one could ever complain about them at work.
They became model minorities.
They became model minorities, and they tried to raise model minorities. And they put all their ambitions in their kids and in this belief that they could prove to America that they belonged and that they were worthy of respect.
What about the long-term impact of stories like this? You track down some older people who were living in Birmingham at the time, 1946, and I'm thinking about a conversation you had with a woman named Julie Beaton.
Julia's older brother, John, was with Dad the night he was shot. And she carried so much anger with her. I mean, more anger than I have ever heard expressed by any member of my family. And she told me things I didn't know. She told me stories about my grandparents coming home from a church revival dressed in all white, and a car full of kids, white kids, came careening down the street and they threw rotten tomatoes at them while they were wearing all white clothing. And how, you know, she watched this happen as a kid, and she's so angry about it to this day. She's angry about having to go to the movies and paying for a ticket and then going outside around to the fire escape in the back and walking up to the balcony, you know, to watch a film. She's angry about having to sit in a certain part of the bus or having to step off the sidewalk. I mean, all these things still live inside her. And she talked about, you know, how she doesn't trust white Americans.
And she said her grandsons hate white Americans.
Yeah, she did. She did. And I called her back and I said, no, are you sure? I know you said this and you know you said this, but this is going to be in print. Are you okay with this? And she said, you know, people need to understand what segregation did to some of us. And I decided to include that in the book for just that reason. You know, anger wasn't manifest in my family in quite that way. That was not the message that I got in my home. And I thought it was important to include it to show the contrast between her experiences and my family's, but also we talk so much about this honest conversation about race in this country. And if we truly want to have an honest conversation, those are the kinds of things that you might hear.
I was going to ask, is this the kind of conversation about race that you think we need to have?
I don't know if it's the kind that we need to have, but I don't know. I know it's the kind that we might not be able to avoid if we really want to be honest about this. And it's really complicated because imagine if she said that in a studio like this in front of a microphone, how people would react to something like that. Oh, it would be blown up and probably repeated because, ooh, this is what happens when people try to talk about race. What I learned in the experience of doing these conversations, and what I learned in the course of working on this book, is that the conversations can be painful and yet still productive if they are in safe spaces. But, the other reason that I thought this was important is because of the message that she's passed on to her children. And, you know, when we think about race relations in America, we often think about it in terms of white attitudes about black America. But what we don't consider all the time is the message that black Americans pass on to their own kids, too. That there's a healthy amount of distrust on both sides. And that's a painful but important part of that equation.
That's NPR's Michelle Norris. Her book is The Grace of Silence, a family memoir. We talked with her back in 2010. For more great interviews from our archives, stop by our website, ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today's show was produced with help from Doug Gordon, Raymond Tungekar, and Charles Monroe Kane. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And Strange Champs is out this week. I'm Sarah Nix. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.